to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikova Tavai, the entire team here in the capital, Taiwan, is goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana أول المسلمين.
in the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Six websites belonging to Iranian and regional news networks, including Press TV. Israeli settlers and forces attack Palestinian residents in the neighborhood in East Jerusalem on foot. The Sudan calls for a United Nations Security Council meeting on a contested multi-billion-dollar Ethiopian dam on the Blue Nile. Stories. The United States government has seized 36 websites belonging to Iranian and regional news outlets, including Press TV. The U.S. Justice Department says three websites linked to Kataib Hezbollah, who are members of Iraq's popular mobilization units, were among the targeted media. Viewers trying to access the websites see a message showing the domains are seized by the U.S. government. The statement cites U.S. sanctions laws for the seizure. The websites of Iran's Al-Alam and Yemen's Al-Masira TV channels are among the targeted outlets. Press TV has announced that its website will be available on .ir domain. We are monitoring social media platforms to see people's reaction to the U.S. government's seizure of multiple websites belonging to Iranian and regional news outlets. Let's see what they had to say on the matter.
The U.S. has seized multiple news websites associated with other countries. This sets a horrifying precedent in which the U.S. shuts down the flow of information except for U.S.-approved propaganda.
U.S. democracy in action. Censoring Iranian journalism. Does it bother EU High Representative Joseph Borrell or the European Parliament that they unconditionally support the U.S., who are found by the Alliance of Democracies Foundation to be the world's biggest threat to democracy?
Between shutting down Iran's media websites and a few weeks stealing and selling off $100 million of its crude oil, it is clear that the Biden regime will take what they want from Iran by force. These are not actions of good faith negotiators.
I think highly of Iran and agree that the U.S. regime is authoritarian. Seizing Iranian and pro-resistance websites exposes the U.S. as opposing freedom and again proves that the U.S. weaponizes the internet. Western media and elites don't condemn this because they support silencing dissent.
Washington is currently stealing and blocking many Iranian websites.
If the U.S. government is trying to silence you, you're probably doing something right. It's still extremely egregious and an affront on the press, but I'm going to take it as a badge of honor.
How is this possible, and what precedents are set?
Political commentator Tim Anderson says the U.S. act of seizing dozens of news websites shows Washington is deeply concerned about its propaganda in West Asia.
And it shows that Washington is very deeply disturbed, particularly about the Iranian media, but also, let's remember, Yemen, Venezuela, there are other sites, some Canadian sites, a number of sites have been taken down, and so the U.S. is acting as though it is the owner of the internet and of a range of sites, and .com in particular, but also a number of other suffixes. So it's very concerned about its propaganda war, particularly in West Asia. So they're using these unilateral coercive measures as a pretext, as well as the generalized pretext of acting against information which is contrary to their propaganda war.
Incoming Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says the preservation of dignity of the nation will form the cornerstone of his domestic and foreign policies.
The honor and dignity of the Iranian nation should not be tarnished in any talks or meetings. In our domestic and foreign policies, as well as while interacting with countries around the world, our pivot will be the preservation of the dignity of the Iranian nation.
Raisi was speaking at the shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam, in the city of Mashhad. It was his first public address since winning the 13th presidential election. President-elect vowed not to allow the violation of any of the nation's rights. He added his administration would pursue justice in various sectors, including economy, society, and education. Raisi said there would be no room for corruption in his administration. He said the mass coronavirus vaccination rollout would top his agenda to protect lives and boost the economy. Raisi further criticized the assessment of Iranian voters, I should say, in some Western countries. He said states proclaiming to advocate human rights should be held accountable for their failure to ensure the security of a democratic process. Israeli settlers and forces have attacked Palestinian residents in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Two Palestinians have been arrested as regime forces raided Palestinian homes. Since May, the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has become the focal point of tensions after the regime handed out eviction orders to several Palestinian families there. Clashes ensued with Israeli forces using heavy-handed tactics against Palestinian protesters in the occupied territories. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warns Israel against the continued blockade of the Gaza Strip and any hindrance to reconstruction efforts in the war-torn enclave. This came in a statement following a meeting of Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza. Hamas hailed the resistance of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, particularly the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, against Israel's land grab policies. Movement vowed continued support for defenders of Jerusalem Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, calling on Palestinian protesters to engage the whole West Bank in the struggle. Hamas said it is easy for ready status for all possible options and that the enemy will not be able to silence the Palestinians or hold them to ransom. Three Palestinian prisoners remain on hunger strike in an Israeli jail to protest their illegal detention without charge or trial. Under the so-called administrative detention, one of the hunger strikers has been transferred to a hospital, but he insists to continue his strike until Israel releases him. Munal Kandil is in Ramallah.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Radanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers, and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal al-Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushat Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the Jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Sudan has called for a UN Security Council meeting on a contested multi-billion dollar Ethiopian dam on the Blue Nile. In a letter to the council head, the Sudanese foreign minister said, Ethiopia's decision to fill the dam poses a threat to regional and international peace and security. The structure dubbed the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been the center of a dispute between Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt. Addis Ababa says the project is vital to its economic development and power generation. However, Cairo and Khartoum fear the dam would threaten their own water flows. Four of the Saudi operatives who participated in the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi had received paramilitary training in the U.S. That is what a leading American daily says. According to the New York Times, the U.S. State Department approved the training. It was provided by a private security company in the state of Arkansas. The firm had previously confirmed its role in training of the several members of the Khashoggi kill team. The State Department says it cannot legally comment on what it has referred to as licensed defense export activities. Khashoggi was killed in the Turkish city of Istanbul on October the 2nd of 2018 after he entered the Saudi consulate there. U.S. intelligence reports have said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the murder. Pentagon's top brass has voiced concern over legislation that would overhaul the U.S. military justice system for crimes like sexual assault. Legislation removes decisions about prosecuting sexual assault and other major crimes from the military chain of command. The bill turns such decisions over to over two trained prosecutors. Now opponents say they acknowledge failings in the current process of addressing those issues. But they reject the bill for various reasons. Some say it is too broad. Others cast doubt over the timeline for its implementation. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has backed overhauling the military justice system that has recently come under scrutiny. Last December, more than a dozen commanders and unit leaders were sacked over a series of murders and sex crimes at a major U.S. military base. A Democratic-backed piece of legislation on voting overhaul fails to advance through the U.S. Senate. The bill received 50 votes, all from the Democrats, but fell short of the 60 votes required to open a debate on the matter in the 100-member U.S. Senate. Democratic senators believe the legislation was necessary to protect and expand voting rights and counter state-level moves to restrict voters. Republicans, however, described the bill as a power grab attempt by the federal government. Over a dozen Republican-majority states have introduced laws that restrict absentee and in-mail voting. Former President Donald Trump refused to concede defeat, citing alleged voter fraud after the final results showed a record number of Americans had voted by mail. A human rights group says thousands of migrants stranded in Mexico due to a U.S. border policy have been kidnapped, raped, trafficked, or assaulted. This is according to Human Rights First, a New York-based group. Documents cases of migrants and asylum seekers stuck in Mexico since President Joe Biden took office in January. It says the number of cases has recently hiked from some 500 such incidents logged in April to 3,300 by mid-June. During Biden's five-month tenure, more than 400,000 migrants detained at or near the border have been expelled. The Biden administration argues the move is aimed at limiting the spread of the coronavirus despite opposition from health experts. Russian president blames NATO's expansion into former Soviet bloc countries and ex-Soviet Baltic republics for the deteriorating security of the region. Vladimir Putin urged cooperation between Russia and the West while revisiting a collective lessons for Europe. Following the Second World War, Putin said the end of the Cold War could have been a common victory for Europe, but NATO's actions have diminished hopes for a continent without dividing lines. Russian leader also noted that European security has degraded significantly, tensions are rising, and risk of a new arms race are becoming a reality. He insisted that Russia is in favor of restoring a comprehensive partnership with Europe. The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea, who visited South Korea, says he would meet with North Korean representatives anytime, anywhere, and without preconditions. North Korea has ridiculed the U.S. Overture, saying it would lead to nowhere but disappointment. Frank Smith is in Seoul.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirm our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Well, that's about it for me.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life. And made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk. Whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
As Brazil's COVID-19 death toll surpassed 500,000, at least hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets of more than 400 cities across Brazil and around the world to blame President Jair Bolsonaro for the green pandemic milestone and demand his ouster. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading, Bolsonaro Out, Massive Protest as Brazil's COVID-19 Death Toll Tops 500,000. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As Brazil's COVID-19 death toll surpassed 500,000, at least hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets of more than 400 cities across Brazil and around the world to blame President Jair Bolsonaro for the grim pandemic milestone and demand his ouster, chanting and holding signs with slogans including Bolsonaro out, 500,000 deaths, it's his fault, and vaccines now, protesters called for the resignation or impeachment of the far-right president. Demonstrators also implored the government to ramp up vaccination efforts. On Sao Paulo's famed Avenida Paulista, protester Dona Nuza held a sign reading, Bolsonaro killed my brother. He took every precaution, but he died of COVID because he wasn't vaccinated, Nuza told Red Brazil Actual. Last August, Bolsonaro rejected batches of immunizations that could have already been applied to millions of Brazilians. According to Folha do São Paulo, only 15% of Brazilians are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, a sore point in a nation that prides itself on its historically successful vaccination drives. At a massive protest in Rio de Janeiro, federal lawmaker Benedita da Silva of the left-wing Workers' Party, PT, told Brasil do Fato that there are 500,000 people dead due to the negligence and denial of Bolsonaro. Thousands of people are no longer getting a plate of food. Thousands are unemployed, without oxygen, in hospitals, without assistance, said da Silva. We are on the street to defend our country, our people, our lives, our culture, our education, our economy. We can no longer die of COVID or starvation. In addition to Fora Bolsonaro protests across Brazil, solidarity demonstrations were also held in cities around the world, including Barcelona, Berlin, Helsinki, London, Los Angeles, New York, Tokyo, and Vienna. Dubbed Trump of the tropics by some of his opponents, Bolsonaro has dismissed COVID-19 as a little flu, which refusing to follow or promote mask-wearing, quarantines, and social distancing despite having contracted the virus last year. Bolsonaro has also encouraged large gatherings and disparaged vaccines. Last month, lawmakers launched a probe of the president and his former cabinet ministers to determine who is responsible for the country's botched pandemic response. At the recent demonstrations, former Health Minister General Eduardo Pazuello and former Foreign Minister Ernesto Araújo were blasted for delaying negotiations for the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. Economy Minister Paulo Guedes was also condemned by protesters, some of whom demanded emergency aid payments of about $118 for the duration of the pandemic. With about 100,000 new daily infections and around 2,000 people dying each day from COVID-19, Brazil is currently suffering the world's second deadliest outbreak after India. The Ministry of Health reported 2,301 new deaths recently. Bolsonaro, a former army captain who has waxed nostalgic for the country's former U.S.-backed military dictatorship, has been behest by political, public health, and environmental crises amid an emerging progressive consensus for his impeachment. Jornal do Brasil recently reported leftist parties and former allies of Bolsonaro are preparing to file a super request for impeachment that combines all 121 previous impeachment filings against him. The super request accuses Bolsonaro of 21 different crimes, including offenses against the nation's political existence, hostility against foreign nations, obstruction and threats against lawmakers, subversion of political and social order, incitement of the armed forces to illegal acts, and failure to protect Brazilians, including indigenous peoples, during the pandemic. According to Poder Data poll published on May 27th, 57% of Brazilians support Bolsonaro's impeachment.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The United States continues to lob accusations of human rights abuses, cyber attacks, and other criminal activity at Russia, China, and several other players in the global south. The United States recently dismissed Syria's elections as undemocratic, doing the same to Bolivia in 2019 and Venezuela the year after. The United States allows itself to invade countries like Iraq in the name of democracy, to steal Iran's oil in the name of counterterrorism, and to antagonize even its own allies for daring to do business with Russia. Therefore, is it not reasonable to pause and ask whether the United States itself practices what it preaches? I definitely think it is. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Since the aftermath of World War II, the United States has attempted to push a rules-based international order, proclaiming itself a champion of democracy and human rights. In the years since, this claim has been proven to be largely misguided at best, and some would say a false pretense in order to intimidate and control other nations. On numerous occasions, both under Trump and Biden, the United States committed what can only be described as acts of piracy against Iran. Venezuela has been under brutal U.S. sanctions for the last decades. Donald Trump ramped those sanctions up, causing Venezuela's economic situation to worsen exponentially and infrastructure to deteriorate rapidly. Although Venezuela sits on the world's largest oil reserves, it cannot refine this oil and has a significant fuel shortage. Venezuelan companies have also been cut off from the rest of the world due to targeted sanctions on its banking and oil sectors and cannot offload or sell any oil in exchange for fuel. One solution offered up by Iran was to trade Venezuelan gold for Iranian fuel. In the summer of 2020, Iran sent its first fuel tankers to Caracas, bringing much-needed fuel with them to the Bolivarian Republic. With many ships completing their journey successfully and unhindered, in August of 2020, the United States took control of some vessels and stole the oil. The Trump administration then proceeded to sell this oil, making millions in the process. To no one's surprise, this practice has continued under the Biden administration, which has chosen to keep virtually all of the dirty imperialist practices of the Trump administration going. On May 31st, 2021, the Biden administration went ahead and did exactly the same as Trump and sold off millions of barrels of Iranian oil that they had stolen at sea. Just like pirates, The unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran, Venezuela, Syria, and other countries continue to undermine international law and inflict enormous suffering on millions of civilians. Countries under brutal sanctions naturally try to find a way to circumvent what is essentially siege warfare, to mitigate the economic crisis and suffering brought upon them. And how does the United States respond? It engages in further violations, resorting to acts of piracy. Venezuela has been cut off from world markets. In order to barter, it has attempted to use its gold reserves. One of these reserves lies in the Bank of England in London. Since 2019, $1 billion worth of gold belonging to Venezuela has been stolen, confiscated by the Bank of England at the behest of the Americans and the U.S.-backed opposition led by Juan Guaido. A court case is now unfolding in Britain to decide the legitimacy of the Venezuelan government and to whom the gold rightfully belongs. Just imagine that. A British court is going to decide who the real government in Venezuela is, completely ignoring the fact that Maduro's government was democratically elected, is officially recognized by the Venezuelan people, by the United Nations, and the international community at large. This attempt to steal the gold is in order to block Venezuela from being able to circumvent the cruel sanctions that the West has wielded against Venezuela. More recently, in June 2021, Iran has sent additional ships to Latin America. The Biden administration subsequently issued a so-called warning to Venezuela and Cuba not to allow Iranian ships to dock. It has also accused Iran of sending weapons to Venezuela. And once again, we see here the colonial mindset where the United States speaks to other countries like they are children who need supervision and ignores their sovereignty and right to self-determination. If Iran and Venezuela want to trade with each other over international waters, this is business between Iran and Venezuela, all right? Secondly, Biden has no right to issue warnings to Iran nor Venezuela for docking ships on their land. These are not U.S. colonies. They are not U.S. territories. You see, this is precisely the level of absurdity that one hears from Western governments and equally from the mainstream media, who continue to think and speak quite brazenly in the same imperialist manner with this colonial mindset. And speaking of Iranian ships, we've also seen Iran sending several fuel tankers to Syria in recent months. Syria is experiencing its own fuel shortages because, unsurprisingly, the United States is stealing its oil in the northeastern regions of Hasakeh and Deir ez-Zor. Due to the fuel crisis in Syria and the crippling sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union, Iran has attempted to mitigate the situation. However, several tankers have been hit in what appear to be acts of sabotage attributed to Israel in recent months. As we can see, the United States steals Syrian oil, steals Iranian oil, and then profits off of this theft. Whether at land or at sea, this can only be described for what it is, piracy. And through the help of the British, Venezuelan gold is also being stolen at the behest of the Americans. This is not only morally reprehensible, but very clearly a brazen disregard for international law and maritime rules. Lebanon has been suffering its own economic crisis for the last years. The inflation, coupled with the lack of foreign currency reserves and the fuel crisis, have resulted in a severe hit to living standards. Recently, in June of 2021, Hezbollah's leader, Sayed Nasrallah, gave a televised speech to commemorate the 30-year anniversary of Manar TV. During the speech, he spoke of the ills that the Lebanese people are suffering and facing, and he issued a striking proposition. He said that if the Lebanese government cannot contend with the economic crisis, that Hezbollah will go negotiate with Iran to import fuel directly. And just dare the Lebanese authorities try and stop this. This was met with praise by many who see the now defunct Lebanese government as unable to handle, but also responsible for the economic woes they face. And some rival MPs in Lebanon, of course, retorted with fears that this would bring on sanctions from the West. Now, funnily enough, very shortly thereafter, it was revealed that the U.S.-backed government in Iraq would be doubling its oil supply to Lebanon from 500,000 to 1 million tons a year. Some suggested that it was Nasrallah's speech that resulted in the Americans and Iraqis, by extension, being so scared that they prompted this action. Nevertheless, it is crucial to underscore how much of a hand the United States, how much of a hand the West has in destabilizing countries around the world, and in particular in the Middle East, as we've seen time and time again. Even when it comes to matters of negotiation, such as the talks to revive the Iran nuclear deal or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, we see again that there is no respect for international agreements. Signed in 2015, the deal, the JCPOA, did not even last the length of one presidential term and was ripped up by Donald Trump in 2018. It seems, unfortunately, that the idea of principles, of respecting one's own word, these things do not carry any meaning. The Biden administration has promised to re-enter the agreement, but still beats around the bush when it comes to re-implementation and has only wasted time thus far. Now, one would think that the United States would be more lenient on its own allies, but this often is not the case. The United States is very effective at pressuring even its own allies into abdicating their own sovereignty. A perfect example of this is Germany. In 2003, when the United States kidnapped and tortured a German citizen, Khaled al-Masri, who was wrongfully accused of being a terrorist, Germany demanded that the CIA agents involved be extradited to face justice. Diplomatic cables, later published by WikiLeaks, revealed extensive evidence of how the United States successfully pressured the German government not to pursue the case against the 13 CIA agents responsible for this kidnapping and torture of al-Masri. Germany succumbed to U.S. pressure and threw one of its own citizens under the bus, allowing the United States to get away with such heinous acts. In 2013, owing to the revelations by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden, it became known that the United States was spying on the phone of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. This caused a scandal, but ultimately resulted in nothing more than a scandal and a media frenzy, and essentially a slap on the wrist. Just recently, in May 2021, it was revealed that Denmark also was implicated in this affair, aiding the United States in bugging the German Chancellor's phone. In late 2020, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo went on a tour of Europe, and he specifically left Germany out of this tour. And instead, he visited only its neighboring countries, signaling the United States' discontent with Germany's work on Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Pompeo went to countries like Austria and Poland giving speeches about how evil Iran and China are, and he openly discouraged those European governments from importing Chinese products, like from Huawei, and warned them not to cooperate with Russia on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Pompeo accused the Chinese Communist Party of controlling the tech giant Huawei and putting spyware on its devices, which, given the revelations about NSA surveillance and spying, and the cooperation of Silicon Valley companies like Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo with the United States national security apparatus, is so hypocritical that it becomes hilarious. The United States does not want anyone to participate in the construction or use of Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline because the Americans do not want Russia to cement a dominant market share in European gas. Instead, they want this for their ally, Ukraine, or maybe even Qatar and other countries close to them to get the upper hand. The gist of it is pretty clear. When it comes to business, the United States doesn't care about what is good for its so-called allies, nor does it care about their sovereignty. The United States wants its big tech companies in Silicon Valley to maintain their monopoly over the tech industry. And it wants its allies and oil and gas partners to maintain theirs over their respective industries. Anyone who stands in the way will be cut off or given the cold shoulder. Another remarkable event that unfolded was when Donald Trump claimed that Germany wasn't paying its bills to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which subsequently caused a diplomatic row. NATO was created in 1949 as a military alliance between the United States and other Western European countries to counter the Soviet Union. Another way of looking at it, especially post-Cold War, it's a protection racket. This is very similar to how the mafia operates. When the mafia says, pay us money, or we will beat you up. People pay the mafia to be protected from the mafia itself. A similar parallel can be drawn between such protection rackets and NATO. In June 2020, Trump called Germany delinquent with its payments, and the disgruntled president of the United States promptly withdrew thousands of U.S. troops stationed there. And even then, Germany still remains home to the largest amount of U.S. troops in all of Europe. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
Now joining me to discuss more is Alex Rubenstein, investigative journalist and reporter at Substack. Thanks for taking the time, Alex. It's wonderful to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Alex, States. You know, oftentimes we see the United States talk about human rights abuses in other countries. You know, they point the finger at China and they slander them with allegations of human rights abuses. They do the same to Russia, to Iran, to China, and they're also pushing this lab leak theory now with China. And you know, it's not just the U.S. government doing this. It's the entire mainstream media apparatus that's equally geared towards repeating these claims. Now, inversely, why don't you think there's much criticism of the United States' human rights record and undemocratic practices in the mainstream media?
Well, we have to understand the media as an extension of the U.S. empire, and you know, a lot of what fuels media reports on this kind of thing is like the NGO industrial complex and the think tanks. These organizations that are highly funded by, you know, defense contractors or billionaires, billionaire foundations, because they have the resources to actually devote, you know, investigative power into you know, these kinds of allegations, whether they're true or not. They're the ones that are able to, you know, furnish the statistics for the media to report on. So, you know, the NGO industrial complex, the think tanks, and the media are all just really an extension of the U.S. empire. That's why it's important to have outlets like Press TV and others that push back on this kind of thing. So, I mean, there's just not money for you know, that kind of information that would really expose the U.S. crimes abroad, which are committed, you know, just about everywhere. If you look at the world map, you know, you're going to see just about every country is being meddled in one way or another, even allies, you know, because God forbid that they have a leftist or social democratic person ascend to power there. You know, that would be very bad because the United States needs its clients compliant.
Yeah, right. And, you know, when you speak about allies, much like the Trump administration, the Biden administration is very much against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that's being built by Russia and Germany. What do you think the goal of the United States is when it recently decides to sanction Russia, but not Germany?
Well, I think that the United States might be on thin ice with Germany, especially considering what the Obama administration did spying on Chancellor Angela Merkel's phones. So, you know, obviously they want Germany to remain powerful as a bulwark against any kind of, you know, spread of an economic ideology that is different from neoliberalism, you know, which is something that they've been fighting in that area since, you know, World War II, and they continue to do in, like, Belarus, for example. You know, big part of this, the reason that the United States is taking such aggressive measures against Belarus and issuing sanctions and such is because they have a different economic model, is because they're allied with Russia, excuse me. So, you know, it's part of that.
So what else is in the toolbox for the United States to kind of whip its allies into shape when they misbehave? You know, what does the U.S. resort to in contrast to Iran and Syria and how it treats them with complete animosity?
Right. Well, I mean, I think globally, whether they're allies or not, the thing is that the military option is not in the toolbox, right? It's the world is becoming increasingly multipolar, and the United States can't compete militarily. So what they do use is all these economic incentives. You know, we have to understand that the IMF, the World Bank, these are also extensions of the U.S. empire. They're controlled by the U.S. They're based in Washington. The U.S. has veto power over any major policy in those organizations. So economics is really the leverage and information. So it's, you know, it's people say, oh, Trump didn't start a new war, but he's been continuing and expanding and he created hybrid war, which is really the modus operandi of the U.S. government at this point, like I said, because the military option is off the table, because also the United States can't afford to go to war, really. So they're, you know, it's they're resorting to these dirty tricks, these economic measures. Sabotage is a big part of the playbook, whether that be, you know, setting an Iranian ship on fire or and recently we saw piracy enter the game with seizure of $110 million worth of Iranian crude oil. We see the same thing in Syria, where the United States is occupying illegally Syrian oil fields. And what the Bank of England did to Venezuela, seizing its gold. This is all part of the agenda here.
Why do you think it is that the United States and, of course, Britain and the West have an issue grasping the concept of sovereignty when it comes to Iran, when it comes to Syria, and, of course, the global South in general?
Well, because they're not, they don't do everything the United States tells them to, because they exercise their sovereignty. I mean, a country like Germany might have some veneer of sovereignty, but they do whatever the U.S. tells them to do, pretty much. I mean, there are exceptions, Nord Stream 2, but, you know, it's their exercise of their sovereignty. You know, we want to do a regime change in Venezuela. We want to do a regime change in Iran. We want to do one in China. So, of course, the fact that they're trading is frightening to the United States government, because even though it's well within their rights to trade, to pick their trading partners and pick who they want to sell to, who they want to buy from, and who they want to, I mean, in the case of China, who they want to invest in.
Well, what do you make of all these people in the media, all these politicians who claim that Biden is a return to normalcy, right? That he's going to go meet Putin very soon, right? And he's going to teach Putin a lesson, and you know, he's going to tell him about human rights issues and cyber attacks. Do you think Joe Biden, do you think the United States is in a position to be lecturing others on human rights issues?
Well, it's totally hypocritical. I mean, like, you know, it's Joe Biden did a regime change in Ukraine, and he did it in the name of fighting corruption. Months later, after the coup, his son got, you know, $50,000 a month to do basically nothing for a strategically important, nationally strategically important oil and gas company. So, you know, you want to talk about corruption, there you go. The return to normalcy is a return of what we're seeing now, piracy, of breaking international law. You know, it's like they're going to talk to Putin about human rights while forbidding Israel to be tried in the International Criminal Court. It's absurd. And I think that the world is realizing just how absurd it is. And we're starting to see, you know, with Biden, who is like kind of, you know, letting all the alumni from the Obama administration kind of take the charge. I think with that kind of weak figurehead, the world is kind of, is realizing that the United States is not going to be able to lead. And it's going to be up to countries like China, who have a competent leader and a more actually humanitarian approach to foreign policy, to show us the way going forward.
Alex, just as a last question to wrap up, you know, there was a reporter in the briefing room who was asking about the scars that the European leaders sustained and how they were traumatized by the Trump presidency. What do you think of that statement that Trump was just an anomaly?
Yeah, I mean, of course he was a bit of an anomaly because you know, it's not so common for U.S. presidents to actually say truthful things. And he did, everyone, you know, he's kind of like Kissinger, where he was like, you know, this is actually how it is. You know, like, the intelligence community cannot be trusted. And that's not like to say that Trump was a good president. He wasn't, but he did show the face of the empire very explicitly, and, you know, making a fool out of himself really reflected how the United States acts on the international stage. So I will give him credit for that. But in terms of actual policy, like, we see that all of Trump's worst policies are being continued by the Biden administration, and in some cases made worse.
Apparently, in the West, it's acceptable for the United States and Britain to behave like pirates who not only use violent means, sending their armed forces to bomb, kill, and occupy other countries, but of course to impose sanctions, to starve people to death and then steal Venezuelan gold, steal oil from Iran, from Syria, and behave like bandits. This is state piracy. This is organized crime at the state level. These imperialist nations are nothing more than international gangsters and criminals. They call themselves democratic, and they talk of freedom and rules-based international order, but there is nothing democratic, nor free, nor orderly about any of their actions. For all their talk of protecting human rights, there is no respect for human rights, nor for international law, treaties, and agreements. Their war on terror, through their war on terror, the Americans and their allies have violated the Geneva and Hague Conventions innumerable times. The Rome Statute has not even been fully ratified by the UK and was never adopted by the US. When it comes to the nuclear talks, the United States tore up the JCPOA that accuses Iran of not following the deal. It's the world upside down. The Biden administration continues to beat around the bush, stalling and making excuses, wasting time, refusing to rejoin the deal, and then gives lectures about international law as it continues to impose crippling sanctions. When sovereign nations like Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela attempt to engage in mutual trade and partnership and cooperation, the West speaks about them as if they are children. Again, it appears that Joe Biden, much like his predecessors, has a very tough time grasping the concept of sovereignty. Iran, Venezuela, Syria, and all other countries do not need permission from the United States to trade with each other. They are not your colonies. Yes, they are sovereign nations, and they have the right to engage in mutual trade and partnership and cooperation of their own accord. The fact that one must re-explain the basic concept of sovereignty is a testament to how awful the Western mainstream media is and how it brainwashes people with a colonial mindset and makes them accept this imperialist mentality and accept these imperialist actions perpetuated by their governments. It is precisely because Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and others in the global south exercise their sovereignty that the United States tries to rob them of it and target them for regime change. Countries who do not do as they're told by Uncle Sam will be called undemocratic and illegitimate and accused of the most notorious crimes in order to justify foreign intervention. As for the so-called allies of the United States, they have long abdicated their sovereignty and free will. They remain in the good grace of the U.S. only because they do not step out of line and do as they're told. The United States will even kidnap and torture European citizens and get away with it because European countries have no backbone and won't stand up to the United States, even when it comes to their own citizens. The United States does not even respect its own allies, and they do not respect themselves for allowing the U.S. to treat them in such a manner. As Henry Kissinger, a butcher and prominent Secretary of State, once said, the United States has no permanent friends or enemies, only interests. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
New research released recently shows the post-9/11 wars launched by the U.S. military since 2001 have resulted in over 30,000 suicides by active duty American troops and veterans, over four times the number killed in combat operations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Over 30,000 U.S. Veterans of Post-9/11 Wars Have Killed Themselves Since 2001. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. New research released recently shows the post-9/11 wars launched by the U.S. military since 2001 have resulted in over 30,000 suicides by active duty American troops and veterans, over four times the number killed in combat operations. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, established in 2010 to account for the loss of lives and taxpayer dollars spent on U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, an estimated 30,177 veterans and service members have killed themselves over the last nearly two decades, compared with 7,057 members of the military who have been killed in the combat. The findings were compiled from interviews, government data, and secondary literature. The report reveals an increasingly severe crisis, the authors wrote, with a veteran suicide rate per 100,000 people in the U.S. outpacing that of the public. The VA 2020 National Veteran Suicide Prevention Annual Report reveals the suicide rate of veterans overall and adjusted for age and sex is 1.5 times that of the general population, the report reads. This rate is likely a conservative one because, unlike earlier reports, the VA only counts veterans who were federally activated, leaving out reservists and National Guardsmen who were not federally activated. From 2011 to 2020, an estimated 1,193 National Guard members and 1,607 reservists have died by suicide. Data is not available for the first decade after 9/11. Among active duty service members, 5,116 have died by suicide in the past two decades. The suicide rate among active duty service members has historically been lower than that of the general U.S. population, the report noted, revealing a significant shift.